So my wife told me I had to stop acting like a flamingo.
She did?
Yes, I had to put my foot down.
Hey, Aaron, what are you doing over there? What do you got going on with the mics?
Just that I'd let our audience in on our office Christmas party.
Oh, no.
We're celebrating the end of a wonderful 2021 and another great year of recording That Was a Show.
Yes to the second, no to the first.
So we're here celebrating with some cocktails, enjoying some seasonal cheer. And of course, because this is That Was a Show and it's what we do, we've brought a few shows to watch together too. We're going to watch a couple of unconventional Christmas episodes of sitcoms that we remember fondly, and then we're going to watch a Christmas episode from one of the shows we covered earlier this season. Stay tuned. Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince, but those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
Oh, Christmas. You know, it's a time for getting together with some friends and, catching up with family. And for me, you know, just watching old sitcoms. It's always been a big part of that. I mean, just kidding. I mean, I have a podcast about sitcoms, so I'm saying that's what it is. But really, you know, it's not that I don't enjoy watching sitcoms. Like, for instance, the episode that I chose for this year for my holiday one was an episode, again, of Boy Meets World.
Your obsession.
Boy Meets World is just it's a comfort show, as you said earlier. It's just something that was a big part of my childhood, and I can just check in with these characters anytime. So the episode I chose was from the season four. It was called Easy Street. It was Christmas time in Philly, and our favorite lovable underachievers, Corey Matthews and Sean Hunter, you know, they're working some jobs to buy Christmas gifts. Sean, because, well, you know, he's a little underprivileged, and Corey, because Alan Matthews runs a real tight ship. As the boys live entirely within the first act of On the Waterfront, the only jobs available to these 16-year-olds are either at a mafia restaurant or down at the docks.
Oh my god, that's like the best comparison ever.
You know,
which one is the Brando in this one?
They both do a little switcheroo.
Yeah,
you know?
Sean
could have been somebody.
Sean is always going to be the Brando in these scenarios. Corey ignorantly works for, you know, a mafia restaurant, and Sean backbreakingly works down at the docks.
As 16-year-olds do. Because I'm sure it's not like some sort of union thing or labor law thing.
One of my favorite things was, and I'm sorry for a segue already, but the IMDb trivia for this episode just says 16-year-olds can't work down at the docks. And I was just like, I'm so glad that somebody was furious about this and had to add it to the Boy Meets World IMDb trivia.
I mean, like, the whole thing is them acting not like 16-year-olds.
True.
It's, we'll get into it. But obviously, Boy Meets World is not a failed or forgotten sitcom. It is a well-loved sitcom.
I think it's forgotten outside of people our age.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to say that I never really watched Boy Meets World much as a kid. And
So, again, it's another disappointing thing about Aaron, yeah, where we find out late in the game that, you know, there's one, yeah, pop culture moment that really missed him.
But I was never a fan, but I also can't decisively say that I didn't think it was a good show. I just never really gave it a chance.
Sure.
And
like me with Recess, I never saw it.
Yeah, and to be honest, watching this episode, I was like, yeah, I should have watched this at the time. I would have been so into this.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like you were precocious like them as a kid. Not that I knew you back then.
Precocious,
but
probably.
Yeah.
The kind of person who would take a job down at the docks? Definitely not.
No, no, nobody was accusing you of being Sean Hunter, sir.
Yeah, you're more of a Corey Matthews, if anything.
You know, so Sean, when 16-year-old Sean, when he learns that working illegally down at the docks is hard work, he goes to pay Corey a visit down at the old mafia restaurant. And Corey, he's not really getting on, you know, he doesn't catch on that this is the mafia. I mean, even though Buddy Hackett is always like handing him like unmarked envelopes full of money to like bring different places, Corey just sort of thinks, it's all pretty normal. You know, Sean just sort of points out, hey man, like, this is the mafia. And Corey gets really scared real quick, as one does, right? And
yeah, he bails immediately.
Yeah, and he quits, yeah. And like, the mafia is super nice about it. They're like, oh, you know, it was really nice having you here, and like, you know, you were really good at your job, you know, we'll see you later, you know, no hard feelings. And then Sean, you know, basically is like, well, I wasn't necessarily saying that this was a bad thing. I was just pointing it out. So Sean takes Corey's job, you know, and he's good at it too, right? Because it's not a hard job. I mean, it's just bringing them a cup of cappuccino every now and then and, you know,
making small deliveries of unlabeled packages in exchange for fat tips.
Yeah, I remember like going into this, I remember being like, maybe it wasn't even a mafia restaurant. Maybe we just assumed it was. But as soon as they start like having them do like money drop offs, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
They're made men,
these guys.
Yeah. So it's Buddy Hackett and Soupy Sales, you know, two old-time comedians.
Come in to guest star.
Oh, yeah, they make a meal out of the characters.
They do. They're having a good time. Yeah.
I kept confusing my recollections with this episode with when Mac also joins starts working for the mafia and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And I realized, well, they're both set in Philly.
Yeah,
so.
Mac is nothing but like grown up Sean Hunter, really.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. So are we supposed to assume that in Philly, it's very easy for someone to get swept up and work for the mob? Like, this is the thing I found wild, is I was like, how is this? They're positioning this as if it's supposed to be a relatable moral crisis for young teens to have.
Well,
like, wouldn't the more natural thing be like, oh, some cool older kid is having them like run drugs for them and they don't realize that's right? what it is.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like maybe they took a job at the grocery store and this kid who sort of works at the grocery store as a front, but is also a drug dealer and is helping them earn extra money on the side.
This is straight up ridiculous.
Yeah. Like why? Like how are we as an audience to believe that it's, and they're talking about it anecdotally later on that, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is just what happens with these things. It's like they see that you're vulnerable and they scoop you up. I'm like, this is not a normal thing to be happening.
So what's funny is his Corey gives him this speech, like, you know, Sean's really like, you know, he's like kind of like, man, I can't believe I kind of fell for this hook, line, and sinker, even though I walked into it with eyes wide open. And like, and Corey's like, yeah, man, like that's how they get you. You know, they prey on your vulnerabilities and stuff. And I was like, aren't you talking about gangs?
Yeah.
You're talking about gangs here. This is not, mafias and gangs are not run the same way.
Yeah.
But like Sean, you know, very like reliably just falls right into the like, you know, like the Ray Liotta like gopher role from the beginning, you know, like not even when he's not Ray Liotta yet, when he's kid Ray Liotta at the beginning of Goodfellas, you know.
And my knowledge of how the mafia operates is based on The Sopranos and Martin Scorsese movies. Yeah. But I will say the logic of it is that they wouldn't just give these gigs to some random 16-year-old who doesn't know what they're doing. It would be a 16-year-old who's like a nephew of someone they know.
Who's grown up in
in a family that has some connection to this. Or, more relevant of a point, probably someone who knows that this is the job they're doing and they hope to one day like climb the ranks.
I mean, I buy them giving it to Sean because Sean, you know, he's got that leather jacket. He's always the most charming guy in any room.
Fair enough. Sean, I believe.
Seems like a con artist, a smooth operator.
Corey would not have gotten that job in the first place.
Corey would never have gotten
that
job.
The only way he would is because he's so naive, you know, and they're just like, whatever, we won't even tell this kid what he's doing.
You know
doing
what?
And
Corey's father owns a department and sporting goods store.
Yeah.
And, you know, in The Sopranos, you know, Tony pulls a long con on a guy who owns a sporting goods store, like just trying to, like, you know, file up a bunch of phony claims on him.
So
maybe they were trying to get into Corey's father's store.
Well, so what I'm hearing is that both The Sopranos and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia ripped off elements of Boy Meets World.
That's correct.
A lot of my notes are probably just sort of generic to the Boy Meets World series in general because this was so new to me. But like one of my things is like, is Corey Sean's social worker?
Frequently.
Okay. And he's always his moral compass. Okay. Like he's always.
Yeah. And like, you know, in typical sitcom fashion, Sean, like, you know, teaches Corey how to like lighten up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay,
they have a give and take relationship.
So that's not just this episode moralizing. No, that's like standard fare.
No, okay. I looked later in the season.
And it's kind of shitty. It is a kind of shitty thing because it's like, yeah, we get that Sean has had a rough childhood, but it's like also people who do have rough childhoods or are like, you know, poorer, like they don't necessarily automatically get sucked into. Like, why is it that that Corey's always the moral one? Like, that's always that's like upsetting because he has this like
But you know what? Corey pulls some shit over the years.
He has some schemes.
Corey cheats on his girlfriend. Sean would never do that.
Yeah.
You know, Corey pulls some bullshit. Like, you know, Sean has always got the bigger heart.
I agree with that. 1,000%.
Corey throws his privilege around.
Yes. Corey has not come to terms with his privilege yet.
No. What other questions you got? Also, hit me with all your Boy Meets World questions.
Is it standard?
Sean Hunter is a soulful young man. I didn't mean to like jump in.
He writes poetry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's a question. Is it standard for the series in general, or was it this episode in particular that the dialogue has such a unrealistically mature kind of Dawson's Creek energy?
Oh yeah, no, always. It always had that. It always had that.
Which
I forgot about that element of it.
It's probably why I liked that. I always wanted to talk cooler.
Yeah, because it's like thick prose.
It's a lot. It's written a lot more intelligently than say most of these like Disney Channel shows.
Okay. Also, the principal hanging out in the classroom and in their house.
He's their
like,
next door neighbor.
Aaron,
I understand what's happening. I don't care for it.
Before our little cocktail party began, Barry kind of clarified something for me. At this point in the series, Feeney is not the principal yet.
Yeah, he's just a teacher.
He does become the principal, but he's still only just a teacher. But as I pointed out to you while we were watching, I don't know if it sunk in, but Feeney is also like family.
Yeah.
He lives next door and he's a man by himself. So he's very much in the fold of the Matthews family.
Yeah. And has been for like their entire lives.
Okay. Lack of boundaries makes me uncomfortable.
That
never goes away.
Yeah. It never goes away.
But also goes both ways.
I see.
Like they intrude on his life probably way more than he intrudes on theirs.
Okay.
He's there for special events. They will like break into his house and like like Corey and Sean run a B&B out of his house when he's not around.
I forgot about that.
Also, the other teacher, the one who's like their English teacher at the beginning of the episode.
That's Mr. Turner. Sean lives with him.
Yeah, I explained this whole dynamic and Aaron was still confused.
He's Sean's, at this point, foster father.
His foster father.
His family has left, and Sean is living with
him. So he lives with the cliche handsome English teacher.
He's the handsome English teacher who's also a rebel and drives a motorcycle.
Who also...
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Who also abandons Sean.
Poor Sean. Sean Hunter, man. He just gets... People just leave him.
Yeah, like, Sean goes through a lot. Like, when that episode... Or when that teacher does not come back, I'm sure the actor just got another gig.
Yeah. But
you didn't realize, like...
Corey will never leave Sean. Introduce... Or does he at the end of the series?
Okay, so me being such a big fan of this, I have watched to the point, like, I just love these characters, so I have watched some, not much.
Of Girl Meets World.
only, say, the pilot, and then... A few episodes where I saw Sean was a part of it. Because Sean was not a regular on the show.
Okay.
So Sean remains a fixture in...
the universe.
In Corey's life. But they are not inseparable as Corey, you know, grows up and becomes a father and is older. But, you know, Sean's a part of it. And then, if I'm not mistaken, Sean at some point becomes a father figure, not unlike Mr. Turner. To the Sean Hunter-esque best friend of Corey's daughter.
Oh, okay.
And he sort of takes, like, he starts dating her mom or something.
Oh, okay.
and has a very cool guy relationship with them.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed this show. It's a completely nonsensical plot. I don't believe any of this stuff would happen in real life, but I enjoyed the ride.
This is about par for the course for Boy Meets World.
Yeah, I would say so. It's very silly. Like, there's a lot of nonsense.
It's very silly, but, I mean, it had Buddy Hackett. It had some really kind of actually witty dialogue moments. And, yeah, it was fine.
I mean, the heart of it is really just, you know, even when I was sort of making fun of it while I was watching it, I was just like, oh, man, I'm just such a sucker for Corey and Sean's, like, deep friendship.
It's very heartwarming. That doesn't get old. I think what does get a little old is just how intense their emotions are around the events that happen. Like the way they're talking about getting involved with these, like, mobsters, and, like, they're like beating themselves up and, like, just talking about it with such emotion. And I'm like, guys, like, this is very dramatic.
It does have the sitcom soap opera syndrome.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the reason why it really tracked for me as a kid and for a lot of people as a kid or younger is, like, that's how shit feels.
Yeah.
It's only when you're an adult that you're like, kids need to calm it down. But when you're a teenager, everything feels like it's the end of the world.
Right.
Like, every dramatic thing that happens to you, you think is going to impact you for the rest of your life, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that didn't track for me is how they were talking a lot. Like, they were referencing that poem from Turner's class above.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
the whole point is, are you kidding me?
It was just fucking two roads. Like, you can't come up with a more original poem to talk about than fucking Two Roads by fucking Robert fucking Frost. Come on, guys.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's like, those boys would not be like the whole point is that they're out to lunch in class. Like, they don't know what's going on.
They riff hard on it.
Yeah.
And they're talking about it like, and maybe that's supposed to be part of the joke. Maybe it's like, oh, they just had to be put into a situation to get them to understand the message of the literature.
I also will push back on their use of that particular poem as a metaphor, because in the context of that poem, I don't think taking the road less traveled or having the choice between those two roads is this type of moral quandary.
It sure isn't. And I feel like the road less traveled in this situation would be working for the mafia. And I also feel like Sean might have been better off working for the mafia, you know?
Might have been his ticket out.
Yeah, he was making some money and, like, you know, he's got some serious, you know, he really does worry about his future. You know, and this was him, starting to make some steps, but Corey steps in and ruins it all for him.
I mean, seeing how Turner eventually abandons him, you know, he did have to worry about his future. Like, so it is just really sad thinking about Sean Hunter.
It was kind of a touching moment when Sean bought Corey that watch with the money that he made from that job.
Yeah. He loves Corey.
He does.
He's
it's a deep abiding love. It is. Like, but you know, did you guys buy engraved jewelry for any of your childhood chums? Like, I don't know if I did.
I have never had a friend like Sean Hunter. That's true. Some amazing friends.
Yes.
But these relationships don't exist.
That's a ride or die relationship. Like, they would bury bodies together for sure.
It is a Larry and Jeff level of ride or die.
To ride or strong. So a guy walks up to a widow at her husband's funeral and says, "May I just say one word?" And she says, "Sure." "Plethora." And she goes, "Thanks. That means a lot."
Oh, God. I'll just have a big gulp of my cocktail here.
So for my choice of show in this holiday party,
let me guess,
Seinfeld. Now, we're going to talk about season 6, episode 10, The Race. Here's a little rundown of what happens. Jerry is dating a woman named Lois. So naturally, he's playing out a fantasy in which he's Superman. It turns out that Lois's boss is a man named Duncan Meyer, who went to school with Jerry and George. In high school, Jerry won a big race against the whole class, and there has been a legend about his speed, much like Superman, ever since. But in reality, Jerry won because he got an accidental head start. The only person who witnessed this is Duncan Meyer, who is now out for revenge. Meanwhile, Elaine is dating a man named Ned, who wears very drab clothing. George finds Ned's copy of the Daily Worker, and they realize he's a communist. Elaine is excited to be dating a communist, not because of any actual political leanings, but because it's interesting and novel. George is excited to discover that the personal ads in the Daily Worker say, "looks not important," and decides to use this as an angle to meet women. How does this all relate to Christmas, you ask? Enter plot number 4. Kramer's actor friend Mickey gets him a gig as a department store Santa Claus. Complications ensue as all 4 plot lines begin to intersect. Ned convinces Kramer that he's being exploited by the department store for his labor. Duncan threatens Lois's job if Jerry doesn't agree to race him again. And after overhearing George's phone call with the woman from the personal ad, his secretary spreads a rumor around the Yankees office that George is a communist.
Oh, man.
That was a show?
We'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, honey, why haven't you eaten your toast?
I don't know. I guess I'm just sick of this regular, boring peanut butter.
Well, maybe it's time we make our meals an adventure.
Whoa, what's this? Wonder Nut Butter?
Try it.
Wow, it's good. It's spiced, but not spicy.
You're such a witty and precocious child.
Spread the world with Wonder Nut Butter's internationally inspired flavors. It's made with only peanuts, spices, and salt, and no added sugar. Try every flavor of Wonder Nut Butter's today.
I don't know. That kid sounded a little old.
Really? I thought it was pretty good casting.
That commercial failed to mention that Wonder is based right here in Toronto, Canada.
Or that you can eat Wonder Nut Butters as a healthy snack, like, you know, adding it to a smoothie.
Also, there are 3 flavors available, inspired by spices from India, Morocco, or Thailand.
I really liked the Moroccan peanut butter on toast with apricot or peach jam.
I've tried Wonder. It's delicious. It looked so enticing. These ads really work.
You can even cook with it, like if you're making a soup or a sauce.
We've been talking a really long time about this commercial.
Yeah, wait, is this meta? Are we part of a commercial? Is Wander a sponsor if that was a show?
All I know is that our listeners can get a 15% discount when they order Wander Nut Butters online at tastewander.com/twas. That's taste, WANDER.com/TWAS and use the coupon code TWAS15 at checkout. And you can follow them at taste.wander on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
What are you reading from? Where is that? You didn't answer any of my questions.
I love this show so much.
There's so many great moments in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the silliest Seinfeld episodes plot-wise that they ever did, but it's one of the strongest in terms of dialogue.
Bold statement, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite part about it is how Elaine is basically obsessed with the fact that her boyfriend is a communist because she thinks it makes her more interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
So she like is so fast to like introduce him as a communist to like everyone she bumps into, and she's like, it's like a flex for
her.
This
is Ned. He's a communist.
Yeah, she
is
doesn't
he?
Like
big communist. Yeah.
Big communist.
She does not like his drab clothing choices.
Yeah, that's her only problem with
it. Does try to make him more stylish, but in theory. She likes the idea, the label of communist, because she just thinks it's a unique thing.
Very exotic.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's an exoticism to her her perspective.
I love the conversation about it where she's like, man, it must have been really hard for you guys after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he goes, yeah, well, we still have Cuba and China. And she goes, well, yeah, but.
And just, yeah, this smirking shrug. And he's like, yeah, you're right. Not the same.
Just got banned in China.
Yeah. I mean, we already were. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Also, here's a little thing that I noticed about this episode this time around that I really never clocked in the probably dozen times that I've watched this before, that the opening scene, the conversation between the three of them, is at Elaine's couch in Elaine's apartment. And it's extremely rare in Seinfeld for more than two characters to be meeting in anyone's home other than Jerry's.
Oh.
So you have Jerry, George, and Elaine all having just a completely like random non sequitur conversation happening in Elaine's apartment. And my suspicion is the reason they open on Elaine's apartment is because it's decorated like hard Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a big Christmas tree there, lots of decorations, which they could not have done in Jerry's apartment on account of he doesn't celebrate Christmas. So that seems to be the reason they did it, but it stands out as a very unusual thing for a banter between three of them in her place.
Do you think that NBC really pushed them to do a Christmas episode? So Larry David was like, oh, like I'm just gonna like have Christmas be the backdrop to this whole thing?
I think that much like how half the famous Christmas songs were written by Jews, I'm pretty sure it was more just like Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld knowing how to put asses in seats.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think living in New York, I mean, I'm sure it's probably pretty hard to avoid Christmas. So it's also, I think with the set, it's definitely an economics thing. Her apartment is in the episode, so they would have rolled the set out that week. So they figured, might as well get another use out of the set. You know? Jerry's set is long-standing, so it's always there. Munch
right.
is always there. You know,
the other for their buck.
Yeah, the other apartments are in storage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with you'll probably notice it, you know, if you really paid attention during it. If Elaine's episode shows up in one scene, it'll show up in multiple scenes because they rolled it out of storage.
Right,
so,
gotta get some mileage out of that room.
But I think it's a great use to have the big Christmas tree, and she's decorating it while they're talking, and like it, you know, it's cool. It's fun. It's
absolutely
fun.
Also, another thing I actually Bryn and I both noticed in this rewatch was that the person on staff at the Yankees who catches George's phone call is the same secretary that he had hired in that episode where he sleeps with her and then offers her a big raise and she's now making more money than him.
Yep. Yeah.
Never really connected the dots that it's the same person.
So she rats on him too.
Yeah. So now I suspect that she was spitefully ratting him out for that reason.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That final twist is the button at the end of the episode.
El Presidente.
Like George Steinbrenner finds out that George is a communist and George is worried that he's going to get fired. But Steinbrenner's just like, so I'm going to send you down to Cuba to recruit baseball talent. And then he meets who is supposedly, I guess, being positioned as Fidel Castro. But it's basically also Larry David's voice, like is similar kind of. Was it Larry David doing it? No, it was a different person.
No.
I think the joke might have been funnier if it was Larry David
but
doing
it's the
it.
Same kind of shtick as Steinbrenner. You just see the back of his head.
Yeah.
Same personality.
It's the same office.
Yeah.
It's
just like flamboyant.
It's a redress set.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
Yeah, it's very funny. Also, when I said like the strong dialogue, I love the 8 hours of jingle belling and ho-ho-hoing. Man, am I hoed out. And then Ned's like, I've got some literature in my car that will change your whole way of thinking.
I really like how many storylines the communism manages to weave its way into.
Yeah.
Like, I really like when Lois's boss threatens to fire her and Jerry's like, he can't do that. And she goes, yes, he can. He controls the means of production.
Yeah, that's amazing. And also Christmas weaves its way into the plot lines, because in addition to like the decor, the bet with Duncan Meyer is that if Jerry doesn't agree to race him, then she might just get fired. But if Jerry's able to beat Duncan in the race, then she's going to get a free trip to Hawaii. And I think the implication is that it's kind of like a holiday vacation type of trip. And and she gets the trip and she asks Jerry if he's going to go with her to Hawaii. Maybe I will, Lois. Maybe I will. And then winks to the camera.
I noticed, so silly. One of the things I noticed the first time this time, and it's so Jerry wins the last race because a car backfires before the gun goes off.
Yeah.
The starter pistol goes off. And as I was watching it, I've seen it dozens of times. I never got the tiny one of Jerry is faster than a speeding bullet because does it before the gun goes off.
Oh, I never thought of that.
No.
Oh,
it's great.
Amazing.
I mean,
it all plays off the great, like, they really, they shelled out the money to Warner Brothers. They got John Williams' Superman score in, and the whole finale is scored to it, and it's perfect.
Yeah.
I love at the end of the race when, like, Elaine runs up to him and he just, like, pushes her out of the way. And she just goes, ah!
Yeah. The perfect physical comedy.
Her and George in the background jumping as Jerry's with Elaine. What's her name? Lois. I don't know. It's a really good sequence.
Yeah.
The slow-mo is, like, perfect. Like,
it's so good.
So good.
Also, it's of course a Mickey episode, which is always a huge treat.
Oh, it's always a treat when Kramer and Mickey team up for hijinks. Like, it is like the greatest.
So for anyone listening who doesn't know, Mickey is a recurring character on the show. He's an actor that Kramer is close friends with. And I forget exactly how many episodes he appears in total, but it's often a plot that involves them doing something together. Sometimes it's Mickey getting Kramer a gig or a job. And Mickey's played by actor Danny Woodburn.
Oh, so funny.
This is also generally regarded as one of the best representations of a little person in a sitcom, at least during that era, because it's not the kind of expected cliches or jokes at his expense. In fact, anytime there's physical comedy relating to the significant difference in height between him and Kramer, it is clearly always at Kramer's expense. He's the one who's like physically very awkward.
Yeah. Mickey is a dominating force in every scene he's in.
He absolutely bulldozes every scene.
Yeah. It's the best. It's right up there with the episode where they're in the medical, the med students.
I got gonorrhea.
You gave me gonorrhea and you didn't even tell me. Thought you'd have fun with it.
Yeah. Communism. You didn't think communism was a touchy subject.
Where have you been the last 50 years?
Yeah.
That's a good scene too. Just a really quick, not like huge punchlines in it, but just a really quick scene of like Kramer and Mickey like storming down the streets of New York and like Mickey just yelling at Kramer the whole time. Oh, just so good.
Which, by the way, is how you do a walk and talk.
It's a walk and talk.
That's a majestic walk and talk.
There are like quite a few like more legendary holiday episodes of Seinfeld, but we wanted to do this one because, you know, it's like a little more under the radar. Yeah.
And in some ways, it's the most explicitly Christmas.
That's true.
Opens with a stand-up bit from Jerry talking about how people dump their Christmas trees on the curb after Christmas and throw them away like they're trash. Like how one day it's this elegant thing that's really beautiful and you're taking great care of it. And then it's, just getting dumped on the curb.
Also, very rare scenes that are just George and Elaine. There's a couple of them, actually. And they're never because they're not friends. They're usually not friends.
Yeah, in fact, there's an episode, now I'm blanking on which one, where they're hanging. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The soup Nazi, George and Elaine are hanging out, and they make kind of a meal about the fact that they're hanging out and having a conversation without Jerry present, because they're really just taking a...
It happens a couple of times over the series.
Taking jabs at him for the schmoopy thing.
It happens a few times over the series, and it usually ends with them just getting too annoyed to hang out anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, or when they're conspiring on the lie.
Yeah.
With the Marissa Tomei plot. Yeah. So it happens, but yeah, it's always kind of begrudgingly.
There's the importer-exporter.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you ever heard of Murphy's Law? You know, that if something can go wrong, it will go wrong.
Yep.
Well, have you ever heard of Cole's Law?
No, what's that?
It's mostly cabbage.
Bryn, why don't you tell us all about the show that we watched?
Yeah, so I thought it would be appropriate, since we are the That Was a Show podcast, to cover a show that is failed or forgotten, and why not revisit one of the shows that we covered this year? So I decided we were going to watch a Christmas episode of the famous Teddy Z.
So the three of us sat down and watched this Christmas special episode of Teddy Z together. Here are some hot takes and live reactions.
Never seen a single housewife show, desperate or otherwise.
Also, that whole, it's streaming on Hey You, so another streaming service.
That's just reality
it's
TV.
It's all just reality TV.
It's nice to know there's one that I definitely don't have to get.
Yeah. Oh my God, look at these
credits.
Are
those like Christmas lights on the credits, or did they always do that?
No, they always did that.
Did they? I don't remember that from last time.
They're not Christmas lights. They're just wacky colors.
Well, yeah, it's terrible.
I don't know if I remember that.
No, maybe you're right. He's the famous Teddy Z. Oh, here we are at the holiday party at the...
Yeah, I love a good office Christmas party.
Me
too. I'm glad we're having one, you know?
Teddy Z doing a Christmas carol. Okay. Teddy, lots of people go to Hawaii for Christmas. Yeah. Another communist joke?
Yeah.
So this is where they establish that Al Floss is the Scrooge of this particular situation. Yeah.
I love his white robe and pajamas.
It's a good look. This is the first Christmas Carol take I've ever seen where the Scrooge goes, wait, so there's life after death? That's kind of awesome.
I also like how they're doing a Christmas Carol, but that was like the most Jewish comedy that I've seen in a sitcom ever.
Aaron, this is like a nice dose of guilt here, you know? Yeah. Look what you did to your mother.
Yeah.
It's pretty low stakes, but it's enough to like jab you, you know?
Oh, geez, we're already on to present.
Well, it's a short
22 minutes.
They gotta move through these ghosts.
Oh, it's Richie. He wears a pocket protector.
Ha, classic. I think we liked that character when we watched this show.
He's scrappy.
I do like that they keep this in line with, like, Bob Cratchit does stick up for Scrooge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the twist going to be if Teddy Z is the ghost of Christmas future?
Oh, just because he's gonna become Al someday. It is really funny that it doesn't work on him.
Aw,
he gets his Hanukkah bike.
But he didn't earn it, though.
Yeah, but it's really funny that he... Because I was thinking that. I was like, how do you do this with Al Floss?
I want to hear this song.
Teddy Z is the magic tree.
And we've all watched it together for the first time. Let's talk about it.
And definitely the last time.
Tell the audience what happens in this episode.
Well, just as a refresher to anyone out there, or in case you never listened to our first episode covering this sitcom, the famous Teddy Z was a 1989 sitcom starring John Cryer as the Teddy Z, a naive young man who falls kind of ass backwards into a career as a Hollywood agent. So the Christmas episode that we watched was called Season's Greetings from Al Floss, and it's basically their sort of take on the classic Christmas Carol storyline. So they do their own version of the Christmas Carol where Al Floss, who is one of Teddy Z's many bosses, who's like kind of a pretty
A more senior agent.
More senior agent who's a little bit mercurial and is a little bit of that personality like, I'm going to take off to Vegas and screw you guys. You're all going to work on Christmas Day. So basically what happens is he makes Teddy work on Christmas Day, which is like another trope that we covered last year for holiday episodes where for some reason the main character has to do something that they don't want to do on Christmas Day. And the whole episode is them coming to terms with that and, you know, finding the true meaning of Christmas. But instead of Teddy Z coming to terms with him having to work Christmas Day, what we do is actually follow Al Floss as he goes through his own kind of Scrooge journey. So, you know, he's the Scrooge in this story and he's visited by the three spirits. And does he learn his lesson like Scrooge?
He doesn't.
And
as we were thinking, as I was thinking back on it, not only does he not learn his lesson, but Teddy just has to work Christmas.
Nothing is resolved.
Nothing is resolved. And although Al Floss has a strong emotional journey when he's forced to confront his actions in the past, present, and how they'll affect his future. And in those scenes with the three ghosts, he does respond to those situations emotionally. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, when that journey's over, he's like, screw it, I'm going to Hawaii anyway.
He wakes up, and like anyone would think after that, he assumes it was all a dream. And then the ghosts say a very funny joke of saying like, oh yeah, well, I guess we'll have to do it again tonight. It usually takes twice to...
With an agent, it takes twice. And as you pointed out, Bryn, while we were watching it, all of his dialogue is that he responds to the situation in the way that an agent would. Everything's always an attempted negotiation. Everything's always as if the situations were a movie or a Hollywood scenario. And so it actually is a good payoff to that, that in the end, no matter how emotional the journey was, ultimately from his perspective, the movie's over. And he doesn't need to change his life because of that journey that he just went on, because he's able to completely compartmentalize those emotions as if that dream was just him watching a movie and then roll credits and move on.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's clever, you know? Like
It is.
I kind of groaned when I saw the description of the episode because I was like, ugh, not another Christmas Carol satire. But this was a pretty clever take on it because, you know, no lesson was learned. I'd like it if maybe like a little bit of a lesson was learned, but maybe the wrong lesson, you know, that might have been.
I think the fact that no lesson is learned is the only thing that makes this original. Like,
yeah, I guess so. I guess you're right.
Yeah, it's as far as a sitcom doing a Christmas Carol goes.
Yeah,
this was pretty good.
I was also thinking it's kind of while I was watching it, how like troublesome it was, because I was like, well, you're in your first season. You've got this like this character like Al Floss. It would be pretty odd to reform him this early on, like to give him like a Scrooge makeover where, you know, like Scrooge lives the rest of his life as one of the nicest guys on the planet. It would be weird to do that to Floss.
Right, right. Yeah, it wouldn't really track.
That's true, because if he did learn anything from this, then what does that mean for the character later? I mean, it's a TV show. He has to continue as this kind of, his character is not quite a villain maybe, but his character is definitely an antagonistic character in this show world. And thank goodness that we spent this episode mostly with him and not with Teddy Z.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if I could have endured a plot line that was entirely Teddy Z going on a Christmas Carol journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, whatever writer was like, well, Al is clearly the one we should do the Christmas Carol with instead of Teddy, that they deserve, you know, the tiny Christmas bonus they got there.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Here's a fun random fact for Twuzzies out there, or Twuzzers, or Twuzzos.
I don't know. Yeah. Whatever you guys call yourselves.
I have gotten into the habit over, I think, the last 5 years. I read A Christmas Carol every Christmas Eve.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I read it, you know, I've read a decent amount of Dickens in my life, but I hadn't really read Christmas Carol until maybe 5-6 years ago. And like, you know, it's like a, it's a relatively brief thing. So yeah, I pretty much read it in bed every Christmas Eve. So yeah.
Wow.
And I'll do it again this year too.
And I thought I was cool for watching The Muppets Christmas Carol every year.
I watch that every year too. You know what? You know what I do.
I do not have an annual Christmas watching tradition. The closest thing I could say is I do watch the Festivus episode every year.
Yeah. And I mean, we do have to watch that soon, Aaron.
We do.
The Festivus poll is up in our apartment and in our studio. I should also mention that, yeah, I mean, this is a holiday party because we have Barry here live in the studio. So it's a nice, like, you know, added bonus that the three of us are together.
Another
and, like,
Festivus miracle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if it's possible that people out there don't remember because we don't really bring it up all that much. But I record every episode separate from Bryn and Aaron, and we're usually just on Zoom while we do it. So this is the first time I've sat in the same room with them while we recorded a podcast.
Yeah.
In well over a year since we sat down with Jonathan Wolf about 27 episodes ago.
So, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, yeah. You know, just to, you know, excite the people out there. I do see Bryn and Aaron socially, so there's that.
We are friends. Yeah. We're not just, you know, podcast colleagues. We are in fact like a weird little family unit here. So,
indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Bryn and I, of course, do have a Christmas Day movie watching tradition.
Yeah.
Where we usually watch three or four movies while indulging on massive amounts of food.
Well, we don't watch the same movies every year.
Yeah, but, I was gonna say it's different movies every year. But it's usually like a couple of classic movies and a couple of new movies. And often one of them is somehow at least tangentially related to Christmas. So was it last year or the year before that I got you to watch Die Hard for the first time?
Yeah, it was the first time I had seen Die Hard. So
Die Hard, Die Hard's on my Christmas list every year. I also watch Batman Returns. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Well, we're watching that this year because Aaron has never seen it. So,
that's guilty as charged.
One of my favorite movies ever. And
yeah,
also
it's so
a wonderful
good.
Christmas movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, for the geeks out there in TV land, the new Marvel Hawkeye series has been a phenomenal Christmas show. So I've been enjoying that.
So that was the holiday episode of The Famous Teddy Z. It was kind of a fun revisit. What do you guys think?
What a show.
Yeah, you know, it was fun. Al Floss is always a fun character to be around.
Yeah, he's pretty delightful. Maybe like the only, you know, actual fun takeaway from that show.
Yeah, it was good. It was fun.
Yeah.
Let's just continue our holiday party, shall we? I mean, you know, this is definitely one of the more fun holiday parties I've been to recently since, you know, it was...
Oh, right. All those things that happened the last few years.
Yeah. Since, of course, we couldn't really gather for holiday get-togethers. It's fun to have one with the two of you and with all of you out there.
Well, thank you all for joining us, listening in on our holiday party. It was fun to talk about these shows. And a bigger thank you for listening to our podcast, That Was a Show, over 2021.
Yeah, the end of another year. Well, don't forget to like, subscribe, or follow us, I guess is how you do it on Apple. However you listen to a podcast and, you know, get it on your little list of podcasty things, do that.
Do that thing so that you can get all of our episodes right away and tell your friends about the show. It really helps us out. We're really excited to keep growing our audience.
Yeah.
And we love that you're all listening to our conversations about these shows that are so much fun to talk about.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to all. I think it's time for another, you know, classic cocktail party one-liner, Barry.
How can you find Will Smith in the snow?
Ow.
Just follow the fresh prints.
Oh.
Wow. Amazing. Happy holidays and cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager.
It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That was a show.
Radio Gizmo. Happy holidays.